Hello and welcome to the Third Sector Podcast. I'm Andy Ricketts.
And I'm Lucinda Rouse. Each week we bring you half an hour of discussion and debate about the important goings-on in the charity world. This week we'll be looking further into tech innovation after our episode a few weeks ago about AI. And we'll be finding out how another charity is approaching tech usage and uptake.
But first, we'd like to introduce a new voice on the podcast in the form of Dami Adewale, who has recently joined us as a news reporter. Dami, welcome to the Third Sector podcast.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Lucinda. It's great to be here and I'm looking forward to the show. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And you joined Third Sector a month or two ago?
Yeah, I joined at the end of February and I was previously a court and crime reporter in Essex covering cases in Basildon Crown Court. I had cover inquests when required as well. A lot of the stuff I covered was to do with like the county lines operations in South Essex, mainly in Basildon and Southend because a lot of the drugs would go through there. But one of the biggest cases I covered was it was quite interesting. It was a pair of pensioners who defrauded a council of £3.59 million through their roles as company directors. And they spent the money on luxury items and holidays. The men are now 71 and 83. One of them actually represented himself in court. They were jailed for 5 years and 3 years respectively and disqualified from taking up roles as company directors. So
wow,
quite an interesting one there.
So that representation did not go too well for them?
No, it was quite bizarre. I mean, the judge kind of tried to make it clear to the man that if he was representing himself, he would be liable to all the different legislation that was included in the court, and he pretty much seemed fine with it. So it was quite interesting to see how it played out in court. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like you were on a really fascinating beat. Now it's all things charity. Tell us about a story that you've been working on recently.
I covered a story last week based on research commissioned by Cancer Research UK. The research was based on a survey of more than 2,000 adults aged over 18, and it was commissioned by the charity, and it found that more than half of them didn't have a will, and one in six of the adults were unaware that they could leave legacy gifts in wills as well. Hmm. Of the respondents who did have a will, around 32% of them had included a gift to charity. So it's just looking at that and how charities can increase that number, maybe by seeking out different ways to educate the public on wills and how they can reach out through maybe the probate service and maybe how the lines can be drawn there. And the research also found that 30% of people who were aware that they can leave a gift to charity would consider doing so in the future. So the enthusiasm is there, I would say.
I mean, there's been quite a lot of work, hasn't there, recently, not least from charities, but also from government, actually, in terms of trying to encourage people to leave more legacy gifts. Obviously, a few years ago, the government introduced a tax break on inheritance tax for people who left at least 10% of their estate to a charitable cause. And obviously, organisations like Remember a Charity have been doing a lot of work to try to encourage people to consider leaving a legacy gift in their wills. And we've actually seen some more recent research from Remember a Charity this week that shows some slightly more encouraging signs.
Yeah, this research found one in five charity supporters say that they've included a charitable gift in a will. And this is quite interesting because it is up from one in seven in 2010. Mm. So the trend seems to be improving in that sense there.
The Remember a Charity research, were they looking into existing charity supporters or was it a representative study of members of the public, do we know?
The study was of 2001 charity supporters across the UK aged over 40.
Okay, so that's encouraging, and that shows that people who are already supporting charities in various different ways are increasingly considering legacy gifts as a way of continuing their support after their life. I suppose the cancer research findings were in respect to a study of adults across the population, not necessarily those who were already giving to charity, high proportion of which were not aware that they could be leaving a legacy gift. So I suppose it's all about getting as many people as possible into fundraising and supporting charities, and in the process of doing that, that they also let them know about the possibility of leaving a legacy gift. Moving on to this week's main discussion, we're here to talk about technological innovation in the charity sector and how it can happen at a time when charities might not have all the budget in the world. It follows our discussion a few weeks ago with Zoe Ammer about artificial intelligence and how charities can best respond to its development. We also heard back then from the British Heart Foundation's head of tech strategy and thought it would be interesting to look more at how individual charities are approaching and making use of developments in the tech landscape. So we're delighted to be joined today by Matt Corbishley, Deputy Chief Executive of Ashgate Hospice. He's responsible for the charity's IT portfolio, as well as marketing and communications, and has a background in HR to boot. Hello, Matt.
Good morning. Nice to meet you.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today. So, yeah, quite a mouthful in terms of all the various responsibilities that you have at Ashgate Hospice, but puts you in a very interesting position when thinking about tech. And I understand that you have a very people-centered approach to the adoption and use of new technology at Ashgate. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So you're quite right. My background isn't in technology. I'm not an engineer. Until recently, I was also the HR director at the hospice, as you say. And I think whilst it's quite common, certainly in my experience, for IT functions to sit with finance, the Ashgate model, as you say, is slightly unusual in that our tech function sits in that wider portfolio. I think that alignment reflects our approach that whilst, of course, if you like, the nuts and bolts elements of IT, those important behind the scenes infrastructure and updates are really critical, and there is lots of that work that's driven by IT. Actually, when it comes to our adoption of technology and exploring new ways of working with digital solutions, it's really all about people and culture. So that's a very different and tangible difference, I think, that I and some of my colleagues bring to that kind of tech portfolio. I think part of that includes an explicit recognition of the support needed with building confidence in digital skills and literacy. So we're an organisation of nearly 380 staff and over 700 volunteers, and we've got, as all charities have, a great cross-section of people with different skills and abilities. But our learning and development and internal comms teams, obviously part of that same portfolio, therefore work really closely with our head of IT and our service leads, because we know we've got that gap to close in that area. But we also know that successful implementation of any IT development or digital solution depends on buy-in from both end users as well as those service leads. So we make sure we invest time in involving those people from kind of proof of concept and testing, getting feedback and responding to their specific needs around training and support.
And can you give us some examples, Matt, of what kind of things you're talking about here in practical terms?
Yeah, so we went live last week actually with a new digital telecoms solution. So that's partly in response to the switch off coming next year of the old analog phone system, the copper wire phone system. But actually, for some time, we recognised the need for a better solution for particularly our fundraising team, actually, with a team who flagged it in terms of hunt groups for calls and quality and clarity of conversations with our donors and supporters, who are obviously, you know, vital to kind of running of our services. So they trialled that with us. We do work with an IT managed service provider who are great, and I'll talk a little bit later about the benefits of some of those third parties. But we presented a solution. We tested it with a small group of our community fundraising team. We then spoke to our reception team and our clinical colleagues, our clinical admin teams. They physically sat down in a room and looked at the equipment. They saw a demonstration. They gave us feedback on what, you know, well, this will work. This doesn't look so good. We're worried about that. What training will we get? So we've got a really tailored approach to how we support people during implementation.
Mm-hmm. And then thinking about types of technology that are used by your staff, but that which you as an organization have not necessarily introduced or encouraged them to make use
yes.
of. Thinking about
yeah.
stealth IT, yes. which is a term describing when staff bring in technology tools that they find useful for their productivity. What's your take on that and how do you approach it?
So at a more strategic level, I guess, what we're trying to do is create a learning culture where people feel that they've got permission as well as the resources to explore those new technologies, those ways of working. And in essence, we're trying to create the conditions which allow our people to develop a digital mindset. So you mentioned earlier the recent podcast on AI with the British Heart Foundation who joined you, and that really resonated for me. And that referencing of stealth IT, that grey IT, is absolutely what happens here. So we know some people will be exploring or testing, and they have been exploring and testing. But actually, we want to encourage that, and we want to know about it, and we want them to share that learning. So instead of saying, you know, you're not allowed to use that tool, you need to stop, our approach now is one of saying, well, tell us what you're looking at, and we'll find a way to support you in doing it safely, and maybe we can all learn from it. I think one of the big shifts we've had in probably the last couple of years is the role of our data protection officer. So we're fortunate that we have a fantastic DPO. But her role has really shifted to one of police officer, if you like, in the early days, to one of enabler now. So she is very much a problem solver and a how can we work safely with this rather than giving the computer says no response, you're not allowed to do it. And that's the same kind of approach we're trying to adopt when it comes to bring your own device at work. So I think particularly for the charity sector, with so many volunteers who perhaps have different kind of user profiles and different preferences to devices that they want to use to kind of enjoy and give in their volunteering experience, we need to find a way to make this work for them. So I think previously I felt a bit like, you know, sitting on the beach trying to stop the tide coming in. It kind of feels inevitable. So we have to find a way of enabling it to work safely rather than resisting it.
Mm. And are you working within the parameters of a policy? Have you developed any specific guidance that your police officer come enabler is pointing your staff and volunteers to?
Yeah, absolutely. So without drilling down into too much detail, we're using a great tool, which lots of your listeners will know about, I'm sure, called Microsoft Intune, which effectively separates out personal data from work data. So that will enable us to allow people to use their own devices as long as they download that application, and we can remotely monitor and manage the kind of work data that they have there. So that's been quite a shift for us in the last couple of years, I would say.
And I imagine that must come with its risks. How do you kind of manage that process of allowing staff to explore these new approaches without exposing the charity to potential harm?
I think what I would say is we've talked about stealth IT, grey IT. This happens anyway. It will be going on in almost every organisation anyway. And this is why I come back to the culture, and that culture of safety and trust enables people, A, to have the time and confidence and quote unquote the permission to go and explore, but actually to tell us about it. So it'll be happening anyway. But the model that we're trying to get in place here is one where it's safe to tell us that you're interested in looking at that, and we will actively help and support you in doing that. So there's a really good example, I think, with the use of AI. And I think for lots of organizations, there will be people in that stealth IT space who are exploring and generating content and potentially feeding data into AI tools. Because we know that people have got an interest in that, and we have got teams who are now using that as part of day-to-day business, it has enabled us, and specifically our data protection officer, to put in place some policy guidance, which we've communicated around how to use that safely. So we've already got some early learning for us around, you know, some of the benefits, some of the pitfalls, some of the risks around data security, how to use it, how not to use it. So we're very careful, and we're very clear that we don't input sensitive data into those tools. But that said, you know, we are using it for kind of generating content in our Marcoms teams. We're using it for generating images. Our HR team are using it for help with creating job descriptions and advertising copy for recruitment. And we've even, you know, used it to identify sort of key themes and trends using anonymized data from our people survey, that kind of thing. So as I said, I think the key for me is about accepting that people are curious. They will explore anyway. We want to know about it. And actually, we want them to be curious. This is what having a learning culture is all about. We want people to be curious. We want them to feel safe, and we want them to share their learning.
Now, I don't think it will be a surprise or breaking news to anybody listening that now is, financially speaking, not an easy time for the hospice sector. And I know that Ashgate Hospice was actually on the BBC earlier this week talking right. about this very issue. And a report came out recently saying that hospice charities are facing a £77 million shortfall in the current financial year. I was wondering how, if at all, this is impacting your ability to keep abreast of the latest technological innovations and to make sure that you are considering them in the implementation of your services, and any ways that you could share of getting around the problem of not having the budget of a big tech company.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're quite right. I mean, the hospice sector is facing kind of unprecedented deficit budgets this year. We're fortunate in that we've got a really good national membership body, Hospice UK. One of the things we've really benefited from are fully funded digital apprenticeships. So we're big fans of modern apprenticeships at Ashgate Hospice in any case. But Hospice UK did a great job of securing trust and grant funding to fully fund a number of those apprenticeships, which went out as an offer nationally. We jumped at the chance to offer those out to staff across the organisation. So not just within our tech team or not just within our kind of QI or digital teams, but everywhere. So this is about seeding knowledge and skills and curiosity across the wider organisation. We got 3 successful placements across our fundraising team, people in HR, and they are just coming to the end of completing those apprenticeships now. So there are pots of trust and grant funding. There are pots of money around to support charities and SMEs in particular, I think, with their digital and tech journeys.
Well, that's reassuring. Could we dig in a little bit deeper into this digital apprenticeship program? And I appreciate that it's still in progress. You said you're just coming to the end of the program, but have there been any interesting developments that have come out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the joys for me in this approach actually is sometimes the not knowing where it might lead you. So as I said, we're coming up to the end of this 1-year apprenticeship, and it's a level 5 qualification. And already I know from speaking to some of those staff directly, they're really excited about some of what they've learned, some of the tools that they're using. And we have committed just in the last couple of weeks to creating some time for them to work together to look at our reporting structure and our mechanisms of reporting on data and KPIs and all that stuff to our board. So we have an inconsistent approach at the moment, but they are going to work together to look at a consistent approach, but then to look at shifting us away from, you know, the traditional tools that we all use and Luddites like I use all the time, Excel and Word, and moving us into utilizing Power BI, which is something that they've specifically looked at and learned lots about on this program. And from there, they will then go on to look at how we can automate some of that data extraction and reporting as well. So fairly small steps, and obviously things that other organizations are already doing, particularly I'm sure some of the bigger national charities. But for us, that's a real step change. And I think the important thing to say is it's just the start of the journey. And as I said, what I'm really excited about is where that might lead us in future.
We talked a little bit about risk around stealth IT earlier, Matt. Can we talk about cybersecurity a little bit? Because I know that so many charities have been facing cybersecurity attacks. I think about a third of charities have faced such a thing in the past year. What's your approach to that, and how do you manage it?
So I think my learning has been that whatever you put in place, and we have got, as you'd expect, all the kind of IT measures that you would expect to have in place, along with specific insurance against cyber threats and around things like ransomware. So we've heard some horror stories in the last few years around ransomware attacks in particular. But actually, the weak point in any attack is we're back to people again. It's the human being at the end of the device that's the weak point. So again, we've invested in various methods of flagging things like spoofed emails and phishing attacks. We're going to be working with our managed service provider to roll out some mock attacks as well, just so we can identify how the organization responds to those, where the weak spots are, and where we maybe need to invest a bit more time in training and support. But that's really, for me, it's really about an ongoing program of raising awareness. And I think, you know, with the advent of AI, again, there's some great resources on the Hospice UK website around this. But, you know, there are some real horror stories around not just spoofed emails, but kind of spoofed voices and even video images. So, you know, we're constantly trying to kind of keep up and make sure that our workforce, staff and volunteers are aware of the types of threats they might receive. So touch wood, we've managed to stave those off so far. But it's a non-stop process of trying to keep on top of that, I think.
And then thinking about what you have learnt in your technological journey, this is obviously just one aspect of your role at Ashgate Hospice, and I can imagine that particularly people who work for a smaller charity will also not have a dedicated tech person overseeing all of that. I just wondered if you had any top line key learnings that you could share from this journey that you've been on that others might learn from.
I mean, there are probably three key points that I'd probably want to make. So the first one is to try not to make assumptions about what the right solutions are. I think it's really important that we take time to really understand the challenges or problems that we've got and understand what the available options are. Technology, as you know, is evolving at an exponential rate, and what might have been an obvious go-to solution even, you know, a year ago may no longer be the case. And I think this is where strategic partnerships with third-party experts like the managed service provider that we work with can really come into their own. But actually, there is a lot of goodwill we found towards hospices in terms of pro bono support from tech companies. And they can really help bring into focus solutions that might otherwise be held in that space of we don't know what we don't know. So we're, you know, one of the things I recognize is that we're bound by the limitations of what we know. But there are other people that we probably need to connect to and speak to kind of open our eyes to some of that. I think secondly, I would say do what you can to encourage a culture of curiosity and learning and follow the energy. So follow the energy is something we talk a lot about at Ashgate. Our organisations are filled with people who are passionate and knowledgeable about all sorts of things, including where digital skills and technology are concerned, but they're not necessarily in the places where you might expect them to be. So it could be a volunteer on our inpatient unit, for example, or it could be one of our drivers in retail. So I think being open to that is really important, and creating a culture, as I said, where people are empowered and feel safe to explore and share is really critical. We talk a lot about having protected time to explore some of this stuff, and it could be really busy day to day. So I think it's vital that leaders and managers make sure their teams have got that time to explore and learn. And, you know, we can then choose to invest in them to allow them to explore further, to form project implementation teams, to help them build digital skills and confidence of others around them. So it's very much about using, you know, using the incredible people we've got rather than looking externally to spend huge amounts of money that frankly we don't have anyway. The final thing is, and this is where the, you know, my people background, and I guess the portfolio that we work with, that, you know, the marketing and comms team and the people and the IT comes into play, which is don't underestimate the amount of communication and support needed when implementing new technologies. So whatever the development, some people will embrace it. We know that human beings aren't always great with change, and we know, you know, other people will be really worried or unsure about whatever that is. So we need to make sure no one's left behind, whether that's a staff member or volunteer, a client, patient, service user. One of the things we just about to do is develop an explicit digital inclusion policy to help identify where we might be at risk of losing people along the way, and therefore what we can do in terms of working with them to maybe look at a slightly different solution to support them and prevent that from happening. Because I think technology, as great as it is, can risk losing people, and probably particularly in the charity sector.
Brilliant. And you mentioned previously the Hospice UK resources on AI and other forms of guidance. Is there anywhere else where you go to look for tips or ideas or just general help about technology?
Yeah, so I suppose, I guess the other thing I haven't mentioned in terms of go-to places for support is, you know, whatever industry you're working in within a charity is to seek out any technology working groups that they have. So again, in the hospice sector, we've got a new IT director at Hospice UK who's been great in forging those relationships and those working groups. So if you're not already a part of those, I would seek those out, because there's always learning and sharing to be had. So actually, third sector podcasts are a great place to go to. I've already mentioned that podcast in March on AI, which was great. So I recommend people listen to that if they haven't done so already. I particularly like Gartner and Forrester. So they have free to view web pages, but there's always lots of interesting information and updates on those websites.
Great. Well, we will get those links off you and include them in the show notes for anybody else who would like to take a look. And just as a final question for you, in your first recommendation, you talked about pro bono support from people who live and work technology, and this really is their area of expertise. I wondered if you had any tips for charities in terms of how they can establish connections with those sorts of people and organizations. Is it a case that they come to you and offer their support, or do you need to seek them out?
I think this is where, you know, kind of corporate supporter roles in fundraising teams really come into play. So whether that's about helping us to kind of bring to life an idea that we've already got, or whether it's about helping us explore, I think making contact with those kind of corporate supporters is probably the first step. And just saying, look, you know, this is what we do in our organization. We've identified you as people who have got, you know, some incredible expertise and experience. Would you be up for coming to have a chat to us? You know, coffee's on us, have a chat and see where it goes. And I think so much of what the charity sector does resonates so powerfully for the general public. And we know big organizations have their own kind of corporate social responsibility policies as well. I think it's often pushing at an open door, because people are generous and they do want to give back.
Matt, thank you very much for telling us about how you're approaching tech at Ashgate Hospice. It's been great to have you on.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be talking about volunteering and what really works when it comes to all aspects of volunteer engagement, from recruitment to onboarding and even an exit interview. But for now, thank you to our guest, Matt Corbishley, and our producer, Nav Powell.